I used to be a property manager in London back in the 80s. For one reason or another, the flats I managed weren't strictly legal, so it was basically my job to collect rent, arrange repairs, and be a buffer between the real owner and the council, should they ever find out he was flouting regulations. It was a proper cash under the table sort of thing, and we didn't discriminate when it came to tenants. If you could give us the month's rent, which was about 60 quid back then we'd give you a bedroom in a shared house with communal kitchen and bathroom facilities. These days, a lot of landlords ask foreigners for proof of their right to be in the country, and I think you can get into trouble if you're found to be housing illegal immigrants. But back then, we weren't in the least bit interested in who you were or where you were from. All we wanted was money. And the same applied when I met a guy called Yuri. Yuri mentioned something about being from Latvia, but I never saw any papers to confirm that. His name could have been anything, and he could have been from anywhere. I met him outside this crumbling down house in Finsbury, one of the properties that I managed, heavy emphasis on those quotation marks there, and the room that he was after was a mess. There was peeling wallpaper, damp patches everywhere, and a stink that was sort of half mold and half despair. It was the kind of place that you'd give a rat the hump, and Yuri didn't quite seem desperate enough to rent it. But after a brief look around, he told me he'd take it. I was surprised, honestly, but I wasn't about to argue with the man. I just took his money, gave him his keys, and that was that. Next month, when I went around to collect the rent, Yuri wasn't in. He cleaned the place up quite nicely, gotten rid of all the mold and the peeling wallpaper, and he'd left a little note on his bed that just said, "Busy at work, money in pillowcase." We dealt with some quite unsavory characters on a regular basis, and I'd had someone try and run a scam like that on me before. As they say, if you play with feathers, you get your arse tickled. When their rent money wasn't in the pillowcase, they said someone must have gone into their room before I did and pinched the cash. And since it wasn't their fault, they didn't think that they should have to pay twice the rent money, and that caused an awful lot of trouble for that character, let me tell you. I was thinking, good God, not another one of these. But then, when I put my hand in the pillowcase, Bob's your uncle, there was the money. It was like that every month too, but it suited me down to the ground. I never had to chase him or go looking for him. He was reliable as anyone was, old Yuri. But then came the month when, well, you'll see what I mean in a moment, won't you? It was a grim Tuesday lunchtime, all gray and dreary out when I drove over to the house in Finsbury to collect the rent. The place was dead quiet, with most out grafting in some manner or another, nothing but the hum of traffic outside and the occasional cough from the guy down below's ground floor flat. So I knocked on Yuri's door, just out of habit really, and when there was no answer, as per usual, I just pushed it open. His room was just the same as ever. Bare except a single bed, a rickety old chair, and a wardrobe that was well on its last legs. I went for the pillowcase, expecting to find the cash in the usual place, but there was nothing. I patted it down and shook it a bit, but still nothing fell out. That wasn't like Yuri at all. He'd only been renting about 6 months, but he'd always paid on time and in the same fashion, good as gold. Then I opened the old wardrobe to see if his clothes were still there and saw they were all gone. It was completely gutted. I hardly ever found a reliable tenant like him, not in our game, so it always stung a bit whenever they decided to move someplace else. I was about to leave and I was right on my way out the door when I spotted something under the bed. It was a suitcase, brown leather and bashed up around the edges. I'm not one for poking my nose in where it doesn't belong, but something didn't feel right. All of Yuri's stuff was gone, and he hadn't left any rent money either. So what was a suitcase doing under his bed? I thought for a second, then said to myself, "Stuff it. I'll have a quick look and see if there's a note or something." I walked back in, shut the door, kneeled down next to the bed, and pulled out the suitcase. I flicked the latch, lifted the lid, and my heart stopped. There was Yuri. Inside the suitcase, his body all twisted up and broken, like someone had to fold him up to fit him inside. His arms looked snapped and bent at odd angles, while his legs were tucked under him backwards. His face was all gray and his eyes were wide open, staring out blankly. There was nothing else. Just him, stuffed inside like he was something to be thrown away. I got up and stumbled back, hand clamped over my mouth to keep the smell out of my nose, but I still felt sick. The room started spinning, and the next thing, I'm out the door and taking the stairs two at a time. I pulled the front door open, ran out into the street before I stopped. I remember how my hand shook as I fumbled for my pack of cigarettes. I lit one and took a long drag, but it did nothing to calm me down. And as I paced back and forth outside the house, I wondered, what the hell was I going to do? At the time, I knew the owner of the property, a man who will remain nameless, was quite an active figure in London's criminal underworld. I just didn't know to what extent. That meant that he'd probably go mental if I just phoned the police and invited them into one of his gaffes. But this wasn't just a broken window or a tenant who wouldn't pay up. This was a goddamn body. I dug out a few coins from my pocket and walked to the phone box around the corner, and from there I rang the owner, the cig burning down my fingers as I dialed his number. His missus picked up the phone, handed it over to him, then I told him all about the body in the suitcase. I obviously didn't just come out and say it, not over the phone, but we had a way of talking back then where you said things without saying them. Once he'd gotten the gist of it, I thought that the owner was going to flip his lid, but instead, he stayed calm, a bit too calm under the circumstances, and asked me if I was sure the tenant had departed. When I told him I was sure as eggs as eggs, he told me not to involve anyone else and asked where the tenant was right now. Then when I told him, he asked me to help the tenant move out. I told him, in so many words anyway, that if he thought that I was getting involved in a murder, he was mad. I said we needed to call the police, limit what they were told about the properties and the tenants, then hope they breezed past us without getting a whiff of what we were doing. But the owner wasn't having it. He said if I went to the police, not only would I be out of a job, but I'd also be in serious trouble. Then before I could argue further, he hung up. Until that day, all I knew about the owner of the shared house was that he was involved in renting flats. Well, dodgy ones at that. I might have been a bit of a geezer back then, but I wasn't stupid, and what he said on that phone clued me into the fact that whatever else he was involved in, it was a lot more illegal than just some dodgy flat shares. My heart was pounding after that phone call, my head spinning with all kinds of frightening realizations. For the past God knows how long, I've been working for someone who was now casually telling me to dispose of a body like it was nothing. This was more than just being some dodgy landlord. You'd have to be a real dark kind of person not to even flinch at something like this. But this guy knew my name, my family's names, where I live, everything. But at the same time, my fingerprints were on that suitcase, and if I didn't get out ahead of it and tell the coppers that all I'd done was stumble across it, then there was a good chance that I'd be going down for something, maybe even murder. I didn't want to go back to the house, and I didn't want to just drive home either, so instead, I went to the pub. There was a place called the Red Lion down the road from the phone box, and even though it was only a bit past 12, I drank a pint of lager in about 4 or 5 gulps just to steady my nerves. The barman clocked me and gave me a funny look, but didn't say anything. He just left me to drown my sorrows in peace. Then I sat there, staring at my glass, wondering how everything could go from normal to nightmare so quickly and so drastically. Yuri was a good tenant. He was quiet. He paid me on time. He seemed like a nice bloke too, so who'd do something like that to him and why? After maybe 15 to 20 minutes of staring at the bar top and weighing up my options, I decided to do the smart thing. I fished around my pocket for some more change and walked back to the phone box and phoned the police. The cops turned up about 20 minutes later, two of them in a panda car with their lights flashing, and I was back outside the house by then, so I gave them a wave as they drove down the street, then showed them the upstairs to where Yuri's body was in the suitcase. I only told them what they needed to know, and they said that I'd done the right thing by calling them, but still, I was terrified. Because I knew that as soon as my boss got wind that I'd been talking to the police, I'd be in deep, deep doo-doo. That night, I crashed at my mate Dave's place over in Camden. I couldn't go back to my own flat, it'd be too risky, so he gave me a place to sleep for the night. But all I did was lie on a sofa, eyes wide open, thinking about how my life was about to change completely. The next day, I heard word had gotten back to my boss, or by then my former boss, that Yuri's body was with the coroner and that the police were talking to the tenants in the house that he owned. Assuming that was true, my former boss had almost certainly sent people out looking for me, so I asked Dave if I could lie low at his place for a few days until it was safe to return to my flat to grab my stuff. He said that was fine, but I didn't exactly tell him the whole story. If I had, I'm not sure that he'd have let me stay. I didn't go out at all, and Dave definitely knew something was up, but he didn't ask questions. I just kind of hung out on the couch drinking his lager and wondering if I was going to end up moving to Brighton, Birmingham, or maybe even Manchester. About a week later, I went around to my flat in the middle of the night to grab a few bits and bobs, but when I got there, the place had been trashed. Whoever my boss had sent had done something to the lock because it didn't look like anything was wrong until I tried to put my key in the door, and it creaked open from the force. Inside, my flat looked like a bomb had hit it. They'd smashed my telephone, ripped up my sofa, broken all my records, and from the smell of the bedroom, they'd gone to the toilet all over my clothes. I didn't take anything with me. There was really nothing to take. The only thing that mattered was getting to my mum's, and then getting her on a coach to Manchester, the furthest of my options, before anything happened to her. Two guys had already been over asking where I was, so she knew that I was in some sort of trouble. But it still took some convincing to get my mum to pack a bag. She didn't know how I made my money, so I had to spill the beans on her son being a bit of a naughty boy before she understood how serious things were. I told her the men looking for me were bad people, and that the next time they darkened her door, they might hurt her as a way of getting to me. The next day, me and Mum were in a B&B up in Manchester. I had a few quid in my pocket, so I found us both places to stay quite quickly, and then after that, it was a case of trying to go straight and earn an honest living for the first time in my life. No one ever found us, but at night the nightmares did. I dreamed that someone was zipping me into a suitcase and then shoving me under a bed, and I'd wake up scared thinking someone was at the door. But no one ever was. It was just my imagination. Sometimes I wonder if the cops ever got anywhere with Yuri's murder. I doubt it, but I also don't think that it was my former boss that had anything to do with it either. He just wanted me to get rid of the suitcase, and if for some reason he had wanted Yuri dead, then he'd surely have given the job to someone more cold-blooded and reliable than myself. No, I think someone else put Yuri in that suitcase. I don't know why, but I know they'd have to be pretty scary to be able to best a 6-foot barrel-chested Eastern European guy like Yuri. Then to twist him up like that, to snap his arms and legs and fold him in half. It takes a very frightening person to do something like that. A person I'm very glad I never had to meet.
My name's Jada, and this story takes place during my second year of college. That year, I moved into a house with three of my friends, Kim, Sarah, and Maya. The house was old and run down, as most student houses were. It was a 4-bedroom place that had clearly seen better days. It wasn't surprising, considering it had been rented out to college students for years. The carpets were worn, the walls were covered in layers of peeling paint, and the kitchen appliances looked like they were from the 90s. Still, it was cheap, and that was what we needed. The landlord's name was Phil. He was in his mid-40s and always dressed like he was trying too hard to look important. He had shiny dress shoes, slicked back hair, and a Bluetooth earpiece that he wore all the time. The first time we met him, he handed us the lease and gave a speech about the house rules. Something about him put me off, but my friends didn't seem to notice, and we all signed the lease anyway. At the end of the day, the rent was dirt cheap, and none of us could afford to be picky. Moving in was chaotic, but exciting. We spent the first week cleaning and unpacking. We were trying to make the place feel like home. There were quirks to the house that we laughed about. There was a light switch that didn't do anything, a creaky step on the staircase that couldn't be avoided, and the basement door wouldn't stay closed, no matter how many times we tried to latch it. Despite its flaws, it was our place, and we were determined to make it work. Over the first few months, nothing really happened. We went to class, hung out with friends, and hosted the occasional get-together at the house. Phil never came around during that time, which was fine by us. As far as we were concerned, the less we saw of him, the better. We paid our rent on time, and figured that was all he cared about. It wasn't until winter that things started to get strange. One day, the heat stopped working entirely. I remember sitting in the living room with my roommates, wrapped in blankets, and joking about how college life meant freezing to death in a rundown rental. We called Phil to let him know about the problem. I was expecting him to send a professional to handle it, but he insisted on coming over himself. That was the first time I realized he didn't like having other people handle repairs. He came by later that day while we were all out at the school. I got home just as Phil was leaving. He was standing on the porch, locking up the front door.
"Everything's fixed,"
he said, patting the railing as if that somehow proved his handiwork. I thanked him and stepped inside. As soon as the door closed behind me, I felt strange. It wasn't anything I can explain, just a sense that something was slightly out of place. When I got to my room, I noticed my dresser drawers weren't shut all the way, and my closet door, which I always kept closed, was slightly ajar. It didn't make sense, but I convinced myself I was imagining things. Maybe I'd left them that way in the morning and just didn't remember. I told my roommates about it that evening. Sarah thought it was probably nothing, but Kim wasn't so sure. Either way, none of us had any proof. We decided to let it go, but after that day, I started paying closer attention to the house whenever Phil came around. About 2 weeks later, I had an encounter that made me realize something was seriously wrong. I had just finished showering and was wrapping a towel around myself. Then I stepped into the hallway and saw Phil standing on the stairs. My heart jumped, and I blurted out, "What are you doing here?" He looked startled and muttered something about checking for leaks. Then he turned and left without another word. I locked myself in my room and didn't come out until my roommates got home. The worst incident happened late one night. I woke up to the sound of footsteps downstairs. At first I thought it was one of my roommates, but then I heard the unmistakable sound of the front door opening and closing. When I peeked out of my bedroom, I saw Phil in the living room. He was just standing there in the middle of the room with his back facing me. I ducked back into my room, grabbed my phone, and called the police. When they arrived, Phil acted like it was all a misunderstanding. He claimed he'd come to check the furnace, and that he'd knocked, but no one answered. To my dismay, the cops didn't seem interested in pressing him further. After that night, none of us felt safe in the house anymore. We talked about breaking the lease, but the penalty for doing so was more than any of us could afford. Instead, we did what we could to make ourselves feel safer. We kept all the doors locked, even when we were home. I'm aware that he had a key, but we thought it would deter him in some way. Maybe it would help if we had to call the cops again. Sarah bought a cheap chain lock for the front door, and Kim set up an old webcam she had lying around to watch the living room. Maya started spending most nights at her boyfriend's apartment, leaving the rest of us to fend for ourselves. But all of that didn't matter anyway, because Phil didn't come back after the night the police showed up. The day our lease ended felt like a finish line we'd been crawling toward. We packed up our things in record time, barely bothering to clean up after ourselves. None of us cared about the security deposit anymore. We just wanted out. Phil showed up on the last day to do a walkthrough, but we made sure we were all there together. None of us wanted to be alone with him. Looking back, I wish we'd done more to stand up to him. Maybe we could have gotten out of the lease, or found a way to report him more effectively to the police. At the time, though, we were just a group of broke college students who didn't know how to handle something like that. I've lived in a lot of places since then, but I've never had a landlord as creepy as Phil. I hope I never do again. I got married about 10 years ago, but it didn't last long. After the first year, we were fighting constantly, and my husband moved in with his brother. The apartment that we shared was too much for me to afford, and I had to move. So I had no real home, no job, and no idea how I would move forward. My ex was out of my life by then, and all I had was enough savings to last a couple of months, if I was careful. At first, I stayed at a cheap motel, trying to figure out my next steps. Each day, I scoured job boards and sent out applications to anything I thought I could handle. Weeks passed, and I started to panic because my savings were dwindling faster than I had expected, even though I skipped meals and limited my spending to absolute essentials. The money felt like it was evaporating, and the thought of being homeless haunted me. I didn't have family nearby, and most of my friends had sided with my ex after the split. The few who hadn't weren't in a position to help. Finally, after what felt like endless rejection emails, I got a call back from a restaurant that I had applied to. It was just a server position at a small diner, but I was thrilled to have anything at all. During the interview, the manager seemed nice, and I told her that I could start immediately. When she offered me the job on the spot, I nearly cried. The pay wasn't much, but it was something, and I was eager to start learning the job as quickly as I could. At first, things went well, and I even made a couple of friends among my coworkers. One day during a break, I was talking with a woman named Carla about my living situation. She was nice and easy to talk to, so I admitted I was still staying at the motel. Carla looked surprised, and then mentioned that her friend Denise was looking for a roommate. She told me Denise had an apartment not far from the diner, and was having trouble covering rent on her own. I had mixed feelings about the idea, because moving in with a stranger sounded risky, but I couldn't afford to keep paying for the motel much longer. Carla told me that Denise was nice and easygoing, so I agreed to meet her. She was in her late 20s, a few years younger than me, and seemed all right when we met. She worked in retail, and said that she'd recently broken up with her boyfriend, which was why she needed a roommate. The apartment was small but clean, and the rent was affordable, so I decided to take the chance. Within a week, I'd moved in, and I was grateful to finally have a place that felt more permanent. Living with Denise worked out well for the most part. Occasionally, we'd cook dinner together or watch a movie, but mostly we kept to ourselves. I would say that we were friends, but not quite besties, if that makes sense. Then after a few weeks, I met her boyfriend Daniel, who she had apparently gotten back together with. I never really liked him right from the start. He had a sleazy style. He would make little comments when Denise wasn't around, things like telling me I looked nice or asking about my plans. He did it in a way that felt more personal than friendly. I tried to ignore it because I really wanted to get along with him, but then he started finding excuses to linger when Denise wasn't home. One time, he showed up unannounced, saying he'd forgotten something at Denise's place, and ended up staying for over an hour, trying to chat with me. That was when I was sure he was hitting on me. I made it clear that I wasn't interested, but it was uncomfortable. The breaking point came during a small dinner that Denise hosted for a few friends. Daniel was there, along with Carla and another girl. The evening started fine, but after a couple of drinks, Daniel started flirting with me right in front of everyone. I could see Denise eyeing us, and I knew she was pissed off. I'd had enough, so in front of everyone, I told him off and said he needed to stop. The room fell silent, and Denise looked mortified. At the time, I thought she was just embarrassed for Daniel. I thought that I had done the right thing as a friend, but I was wrong. After the guest left, Denise confronted me. She accused me of trying to create problems between her and Daniel. I told her about what he'd been doing, but she didn't believe me. She said if I had a problem with him, I should have come to her privately, instead of embarrassing her. After almost an hour of arguing, we went to our separate rooms, both furious. Then in the middle of the night, I was woken up by the sound of my door opening. At first, I thought it was a dream, but then I saw Denise standing there. She had a knife in her hand and a crazy look in her eyes. Then before I could fully process what was happening, she lunged at me. I rolled off the bed onto the floor before she got to me. Then I managed to grab the duvet and used it to cover myself. She slashed at me, cutting through the fabric and grazing my arm. When she saw the blood, she must have snapped out of it. She stopped, then dropped the knife and backed away from me. As she was leaving the room, I could hear her muttering, "I'm sorry," over and over. I grabbed my phone and called the police, and Denise was arrested. I spent the rest of the night in the hospital, getting stitches for the cut on my arm. The doctor said I was lucky it wasn't worse. After Denise was taken into custody, I knew I couldn't stay in the apartment. The thought of sleeping there another night made my stomach turn. I packed my stuff the next day and moved into the same motel that I stayed at before. I kept working at the diner because I couldn't afford to quit. Carla tried to talk to me a few times, but I avoided her. I didn't blame her for what happened, but I couldn't bring myself to act like everything was normal. Whenever she brought up Denise, I changed the subject or walked away. Within a month, I found a small studio apartment I could afford. It wasn't much, just a single room with a kitchenette and a tiny bathroom, but it was a step up for sure. Life didn't magically get better overnight, but I took things one day at a time. The scar on my arm never healed completely, and every time I look at it, I think about how close I came to losing my life.